The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. This content is created in partnership with our sponsor, NetWealth Investments Limited, ABN 85090 569 109, AFSL 230 975, and is limited to publicly available information. Before acting on any general advice, you should consider whether appropriate and obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license and does not provide any financial advice or services or endorse any general advice. If a PDS or IM exists, you should obtain a copy and review it thoroughly before making a decision.
I'm Patrick, Head of Technology at professional services firm Collins SBA. I'm a former financial advisor who just loves solving business problems and creating better client experiences using technology. Join me each week as we unpack the tech on offer to advice professionals, stay on top of tech trends, and help you break free from the analysis paralysis experience when building and maintaining a great tech stack.
Discover a world of advice. Join Matt Heiner, CEO of NetWealth, as he chats to industry professionals and thought leaders on the latest technologies, business models, changing demographic patterns, and general trends impacting wealth management. Listen at netwealth.com.au/between meetings. This ad is presented by NetWealth Investments Limited and does not consider individual circumstances. Seek professional advice and read the relevant PDS to determine if NetWealth is appropriate for you. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future performance.
To give listeners of the Advice Tech podcast another avenue to solve technology problems that matter most and efficiently evaluate the landscape of Advice Tech providers, Ensemble has launched an Advice Tech space on its platform. If you want to know how your advice peers are solving their tech challenges, big and small, it's the place to go. Head to the Ensemble platform or use the link in the show notes to join today.
Today's episode is packed with analogies and acronyms, but it's all grounded in something incredibly practical: Encore Advisory Group's Big Six Trends for 2026 and what they mean over the next 12 to 18 months. Joining me is Mark Zaglis, Principal of Encore Advisory, one of Australia's most respected business coaches and growth strategists in financial services, with over 25 years' experience helping advice firms scale, strengthen leadership, and drive better commercial outcomes. I got a huge amount out of this conversation, and I strongly encourage you to follow Mark and Brendan on LinkedIn, where they've been doing much deeper dives into each of these trends. And to kick things off, I asked Mark what the oldest piece of tech he owns is, whether he still uses it.
Yep, Patrick, thanks for having us on the Advice Tech podcast. The oldest tech that really made me think, probably my Canon camera that was released in 2012. It's an old DSLR camera. Most of the world has moved into mirrorless. Mine is more closely aligned to film camera these days, but she still just works.
Your beauty. And have you got anything, like, I know doing a little bit of research that is a big part of your hobbies and backgrounds and interests, is that right, in terms of adventure photography?
Yeah, I feel in photography and I just love it. Landscape photography, travel photography, kind of dived into it, events, travel around the world taking photographs. And I learned pretty quickly that it wasn't about the camera. I got caught up in what photographers call gear acquisition syndrome. And then I realized it wasn't the camera and it wasn't the lens. It was, you just got to go out there and learn how to take a photograph. But it's taken me to some pretty exquisite parts of the world, like Antarctica or Iceland or Africa. So it's a trusty travel companion.
I love it. And I think that's a perfect segue or even just analogy in terms of gear acquisition syndrome and what we're seeing with AI and tech stacks and all that sort of coming together. Do you mind sort of taking us through maybe just one or two ways that you're using AI, whether it's personally or professionally or both?
It's both. And I'm going to start with photography. I started seeing AI, it wasn't called AI, 3, 4, 5 years ago coming into the photography world, not so much in the hardware, but in the software, the way that we produce photographs these days, not in the dark room, but sitting at the computer. And that transition, I'm sitting here going, a 1 or 2 hour process was now taking me 10 or 15 minutes. And as I started getting behind the scenes, I just saw what was coming from a professional and life point of view with AI. And so, one, use it in my personal life. And two, I'm probably a bit of a mad scientist in this space professionally. I use it a lot as a thinking partner, not just a writing tool. It helps me test ideas, speed up research, kind of reduce the I'm just staring at a blank page time. And, you know, one of the things that I definitely learned both using it with my photography and with business is that it speeds up, it helps with clarity, but what it doesn't do is replace judgment. And what I understand about AI, and I use that term very loosely because I'm certainly not an expert, is that, you know, AI pattern recognizes. It's not a thinking or a judgment tool. And once you understand that, you get much better results from the tool itself than thinking that it is a thinking tool and it's going to do that for you.
I love it. And I think that, yeah, even with where large language models are today, it can often feel like it's doing a lot of that thinking for you. But as you mentioned, you just cannot outsource that. You mentioned you're not an expert in AI, but you're definitely an expert across this profession. You've been working with advice businesses since at least, I think it's 2002. What does 2026 feel like compared to, I guess, other inflection points that you've seen across the industry or the profession as a whole?
Yeah, that's a good question, Patrick. My grey hairs will tell people that I've been around for a little while. The thing that I've noticed most in the last 6-8 months is that the pace of change has doubled inside advice firms and the margin for error has halved. 2026 feels like one of those years where multiple forces are just colliding at a rapid rate. Advice is scarcity. We've known that for a while. Rising client demand also for a while, but that's been matched with rising client scrutiny. And AI is the accelerant to that. It's not so much about the trajectory of that, but it's about the acceleration or the velocity of that. And that is putting business models under pressure. Talent acquisition and retention, opportunity in the M&A space, organic growth, mergers. It's just layer upon layer. And it's kind of almost like you're out there body surfing at Bondi Beach and you get hit by a wave and it pushes you under. And as soon as you come up and take a breath, you get hit by another one. And so it's just this shortness of breath that we're starting to see and notice inside boardrooms. And we're starting to spend a bit of time trying to just slow the pace, to slow it down to speed things up.
Goodness me. I know the boardroom point is a good one in terms of, I know you work across, you know, advice, accounting, as well as mortgage broking. Is there one thing that I guess you would say like the best run businesses have in common right now with all of the things that are happening, all of those variables, as you mentioned?
Oh, okay, Patrick, that's a big question. I'd answer that question by taking a step back. There are three fundamental changes that have occurred in our industry in the last little while. Advice is no longer advisor run, it's entrepreneurially led. Number two, business ownership is a partnership, right? It's no longer one or two owners of a business, it's 5 or 6 or 7, it's multi-partnered. And that requires different governance and leadership approaches. So that would be underpinning point number one, that the kind of the phrase that what got me here is not going to get me there, it rings very, very true. And thirdly, underpinning all of this, advice now more than ever before, it's a digital game, right? There's always been technology in advice, of course, but it's been very much a people and process business model. It is now teams and technology, and advice is a digital business, and it's only going to accelerate with AI, not because of AI, but it will accelerate because of that. So those the three things I would, to answer your question, leadership, governance, and getting clarity around the digital nature of advice into the future.
Ensemble Progress is for advisors who want real momentum, not just inspiration. Find out more at ensemble.com/membership.
I love it. And hopefully a good segue into, like, you've published the big six trends of 2026, which I think has really cut through a lot of that noise. And I guess even hearing that answer, how a lot of those are really have fallen out of what you're seeing across those all sort of three industries or professions. Before we, I guess, jump into each of those sort of six trends, can we reel them off sort of 1 to 6, but then is there also something that connects all of them together? And I'm particularly interested in number one, which I'm sure you'll let us know what it is. But yeah, take us through the big six trends. And is there anything that sort of weaves them together as part of it, as you sort of come up with this with your colleague, Brendan?
Yeah, okay. So trend number one, the rise of the koutou. We'll get into that. Trend number two, unearthing sales engines. My all-time favorite topic. Trend number three, advisors are on the move. Trend number four, AI is transforming business models. Trend number five, conflicts of interest, the sequel. And trend number six, the growing gap between knowing and doing. And to bring those together, I would say this, that what we did was over the Christmas New Year break, my business partner and I, Brendan Johnson and I, We sat down and we just looked over the hundreds and hundreds of hours that we have spent in the last 12, 18 months alone inside boardrooms, management meetings, project sessions, workshops, one-on-one advisor meetings, practice manager meetings, general manager meetings, staff meetings, interviewing staff as part of cultural change programs. We just sat there and reflected on what are the common threads that can give our clients and the industry a bit of a forward view. We're not so much into big, bold predictions, right? As opposed to, well, can you join the dots and paint a picture for the next 12, 18 months that can help someone practically today? Because that's the thing that owners and leaders struggle with. It's like, I've got 1,000 things coming at me professionally, let alone at home. I just can't take the time to stop and think. But that's our job, to stop and think. So those were the six thematics and themes that we looked at and drew a line for the next 12, 18 months that we really want to go hard at sharing, you know, into the community, and also that we get to work with our clients. And I'd say, to answer your second question, the common denominator is the word leadership. And for a lot of people, it's boring. It's a boring word. But I'm going to liken leadership to oil in the car engine. You don't notice it until something goes wrong or it's missing. When oil is missing in the engine, it will break. When leadership is missing in the business, it breaks. And we are on a mission to make boring sexy again, right? Because you cannot run. You could get away without leadership when businesses were $3, $4 million in revenue. You know, your staff had been with you for many years and you just knew each other. Now you're running 50, 60 to 100 people enterprises. You can't do that without leadership. And I'll finish on this point. Advisors were running businesses like a marathon. I'm just an advisor, not just, I'm an advisor and I'm running the marathon, right? As hard as that is. Now, advice businesses are the proverbial Ironman triathlon. You have the swim leg, the bike leg, and the run leg. You have to bring what I call the three hats, the owner hat, the advisor hat, and the leadership hat. And unless you balance all those three things, then you just either the business is going to break, or two, you're just not going to realize the ambition that you have commercially and personally from your enterprise. It's simple as that.
Simple as that. That's right, Farah. No, you do such an incredible job, Mark, at making that complex, all those themes, just distilling them down into those, you know, those trends, for example, as well as the, Mr. Analogy. That's just fantastic in terms of the triathlon. So I'm just trying to reflect back on the overarching point on leadership. And typically we think about that as maybe, you know, the CEO, managing director, et cetera. But obviously there's a leadership team normally in these businesses. You mentioned sort of 50, 60, 100 people. But, you know, everyone has or can possess and, you know, elicit leadership qualities. Can I link that to trend one around the rise of the COTO and stronger operating models? That is a massive part of any business. So operations and technology, and it's where a lot of that leadership is really in the spotlight when it comes to making tech decisions, rolling it out properly, the change management. How has that that trend been plucked from all those learnings? You mentioned the boardrooms being in these firms and project sessions, et cetera, to name just a couple of those sort of contexts. But yeah, talk us through trend number one, the rise of the COTO. This intrigues me a great deal. And yeah, tell us all about it.
Yeah. Patrick, I'll start by answering that by giving a macro trend and then bring it into the micro. So kind of a thematic at the industry level and then what's going on inside businesses, whether you're a 3, 4, 5 person business or a 50, 60 person business, it's equally applicable. Two things have happened broadly in the last 5, 6 years, predominantly because of bank wealth exit. With the withdrawal of bank ownership of advice, the investment, the capital that was being invested into the advice industry started to flow more to the front end, to the advice end. Previously, it was all in the products. And so with all of that development in the back end, advisors were just left to just figure out the client experience, the document preparation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you really have a lot of technology or digital assets other than X-Plan sitting at the front end. People were cobbling together macros in Word, for example. Well, you fast forward to today, that has significantly changed. Now, we've still got a long ways to go, right? But, and I'm not going to sit here and rattle off all of the different pieces of technology that have come to the market, but we're already seeing that change. And so now there's very real pieces of technology, assets of substance for owners to chew on, to think about, well, how do I plug them into the business? And what happened was, what happens when you give, I'm a proverbial kid, a whole bunch of new toys into the playpen? I grab them and I just start playing with them, right? I've got no idea what they are or how they fit together, but I play with one, get bored, put down the next one, get bored, get the next one, get bored. And so this is what's been happening in the last few years, that businesses have been going, oh, I need to take a better photograph. I'll get a better camera. Oh, the photograph is terrible. I'll buy a new camera. Oh, that photograph's terrible. I'll buy a new camera. And so it's just been, businesses have been going, that piece of technology, that CRM doesn't work. I'm going to get a new one, right? And so it's just this constant layering technology or widgets on what I call a broken system. And meanwhile, the operations manager or the practice manager or staff is sitting in another room going, you keep throwing all this stuff over the fence and I'm trying to make it work and it's just breaking. And so what we've got is businesses are getting capped, teams and people are frustrated and overwhelmed, right? Because all of this new great technology is coming in, but we're struggling with it. And so what's happening is EBITs are staying in the 20%, right? Because you're just spinning wheels, wasting a lot of time. And AI is the danger here, is that people now see AI and it's just accelerating what's been happening. Oh, it's another tool. How do I use that? I'll drop everything else and I'll try that. And so what we saw was that no longer can you have these two separate rooms or two separate people or two different conversations, even if it's the same person, but having separate conversations about what's the right piece of technology in one room and then what's the operating process or workflow or SOPs in another room. The more and more we started to bring those together and leveraging the insights and the knowledge of people that's already got this in the business, but by asking different questions with a different perspective, we started getting a lot of what I call aha moments. And so we went, okay, all right, there's definitely something here.
I love it. I think I'm just reflecting on the businesses that I've been in or exposed to, and it really are the best ones. They function like that at the very least as a mindset. Do you think, I'm just thinking about, you know, we mentioned 50 to 60 to 100 people firms. It's obviously, you know, the bigger the team, the more space we have for that to be considered. If we go back to sort of 3 to 5 person firms, does it become more of a, as you're alluding to, more of a mindset, more of a way of thinking, more of a just consolidating, as you mentioned, those meetings to talking and thinking about this as one function? So the COTO being, I don't even know if we called it out, we probably did, but it was the Chief Operations and Technology Officer, I believe, acronym Central.
Very, very, yes, Chief Operating and Technology Officer, right? So literally just bringing operations technology together, and who doesn't love an acronym? I don't think we've had a new one in the industry in a few years, so Encore wanted to stamp its mark, and maybe that might be one of the legacies we leave. Look, that's a great question, Patrick, and I'm going to take us in the DeLorean all the way back to sort of 2005. And I know all of your listeners, our community will get this. The rise of the COTO, I believe, will be as instrumental to the growth of advice businesses as the introduction of the practice manager was back in the mid-2000s. And everybody has that experience. Now, like practice managers today are called operations managers, general managers, COOs, a whole range of things, but they all do the same function. And that didn't start with a full-time individual. It was a mindset, or it was spread across a couple of different roles. That's the same. Think about that now with the rise of the COTO. And so that should immediately help firms of whatever size and scale go, ah, okay, I know how I applied that back then and what it's grown to. I can see that as a pointer for this particular role. And so the key is that it's not about having a full-time person today, right? Certainly there are firms that are doing that and they're starting to practice with it, if you like, right? Some are employing full-on kind of CTO levels with an operational background. Others are employing someone who's got that operational and technology curiosity reporting to the operations manager or the general manager. So there's many different ways that you can cut this. So I'd rather people not worry about the role description and it's another FTE. It's about the mindset. Who is the person in the business who owns, is accountable, not responsible for doing it all, but is accountable for thinking through how we operationalize with processes and technology together inside the business? So it's about the ownership of, I own the service model and how we deliver advice to the clients and how that gets stitched together in terms of, call it a process document, a workflow tool, and what is the first thing that we implement or fix versus second, third, and fourth. It's about the ownership. And I think many people ask about outsourcing in this sort of context. Absolutely, parts of the model can be outsourced for sure. I mean, it's about how you get the job done, whether it's you own the resource or not is kind of almost immaterial. What is key is you can't outsource the accountability. And too many firms and owners think that with an outsourced partner, the responsibility for leadership and management now sits with the outsourced provider and not them. And this goes back to my common thread, leadership. Leadership is the 42.2 kilometers at the end of the Ironman. If you outsource that, you do not finish the Ironman event. In fact, you are disqualified from the event if you outsource it. So you can't outsource the leadership of this. You can outsource the support and doing.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for taking us through that, Mark. I think it's a great point in terms of, in general, like being able to outsource, or you can't outsource accountability, going back to the original conversation about AI. So obviously not switching your brain off or trying to hold an AI accountable. If you think about, you know, we mentioned the boardrooms that you're sitting in before, so Brendan and yourself, is like when you're having those conversations and you've probably gone down that path of the mindset of the COTO, does it come down to when, you know, leaders are expressing frustration, is it the tech itself, is it the camera, or is there something sort of deeper around their sort of general decision-making strategy that's maybe separate from that COTO mindset?
Yeah, that's a good question. Absolutely, it can come down to the tech or the camera, right? There's no question, right? It absolutely can be that. If I want to shoot sports in action, I can't have a camera that is solely built for landscape, right? I can take a photo, but it's going to be a bit inferior. So let's just clear that point up. But it's rarely tech alone. And tech or an outsourced partner, it's the easy finger to point. Why? Because vulnerability is difficult. And leadership is about being vulnerable, right? It's about, I don't have all the questions, sorry, I have all the answers, but I'll ask the questions because I have a curious mindset. And so the frustration is usually inconsistent decision-making or ownership. It's kind of, oh, you own that part, I'll do this part, and kind of nobody owns it, right? And or a lack of, well, how does the business actually run and do we want it to run? And so leaders know that things are not working as they should, but they often can't isolate. And I don't think it's a capability thing. It's just taking the time to stop and think deeply on it, whether the root cause is a people, process, data, tech, or leadership. And it's usually a combination. The deeper frustration we hear from people is we've spent money, we've added tools, we're busy, and it still feels harder than it should be or what it was.
Yeah, and as you say, like in terms of AI being a danger or a risk, like I still feel like a lot of firms are skipping even that basic data in one place or at least retrievable step. Then you've got automation, then you've got AI trying to skip that and then causing, mate, more chaos than good or benefit. And then I'm just also thinking about the COTO once again as a mindset or a framework or a person. Do you feel that that also encapsulates the change management? Because that has to be a massive part of the actual rollout of, you know, tech that they have, say, decided or they've come to the decision as a board. Where does that fall into the role of that sort of COTO person or framework or mindset?
I love that question, Patrick. People that know me and us know that we are massive on change management. Another term for change management is implementation. And if you think about data and foundations as the south pylon of the harbour bridge, change management and engaging your people is the North pylon. Doesn't matter what you're doing between that. If those two pylons aren't set deep, then the more you layer on and the more pressure you put on through growth ambitions, it comes collapsing down. I think change management is, look, it took me a long time. I heard this term back in the 1990s sitting in corporate land, and I reckon it took me probably 15 years to figure out, well, what the hell does that actually mean, right? It's about articulating what we're doing to your people in words and ways that they understand, not in project speak or tech speak or product speak. It's about articulating the benefit to them in, it's essentially selling to your people what you're doing the same way that we need to be selling to clients in order for them to part with their hard-earned cash to purchase our advice product. And I have a rule. It's called the 7x7. If you haven't communicated to your people 7 times in 7 different ways, then you haven't communicated change. Now, that is 49 pieces of communication, and that's an email, a one-on-one, it's a town hall, it's a PowerPoint deck, it's one-on-one conversations, it's small teams. But with our clients, it's the 7x7. We are 7x7. You forget that owners, and I'm the same, we sit in boardrooms and management rooms, and we will have had 49 different conversations before we decide to purchase a piece of tech or to make a change. But then we just put it all together on one slide, present it once, not communicate it, present it once, and expect 10, 15, 20 other people to just absorb it when it's the first time they've heard it. And we wonder, well, how come they're not buying into this? So look, change management is a whole topic on its own, Patrick. I'll come back and we can dive into that one.
I look forward to it. No, I think I have definitely took up a lot of your time on trend number one. So we've got to get through them. I think it's a really good point around, one of your many points around, you know, just articulating to your people. I assume that links to trend number two. So unrusting that sales engine, organic growth, people having a reason or a why to come into the business, as well as having an incentive or just motivation to, I guess, sell, which is what a big part of, you know, growing those businesses organically is. Can you take us through trend number two at a high level?
Yeah, I'll hit this one a little bit quicker for you, Patrick. So again, let's go back into the macro themes, right? So please, everyone, take this as a generalized statement. There are two broad cohorts of advisors today. There are those advisors that built this industry, yeah, that they were knocking on doors, selling insurance, then transitioned into superannuation. They had to sell. If they didn't sell, they didn't feed their families. The majority of those advisors are now owners sitting on boards running businesses. They're the entrepreneur, or they're successioning out. The second broad cohort of advisors are coming, and they're new. The last 10, 15 years, they've bought into books or inside those businesses, and they've been predominantly serving. They haven't had to sell. And so we've got this gap between those with the capability and no longer on the tools, and those that are on the tools don't have the capability or the confidence. And so that, in the context of advisors and advice businesses, have been feasting with the drop in advisor supply and the continued client demand, it hasn't been a need. We weren't doing any sales and marketing work 2 years ago. In the last 2 years, we can't keep up with the demand. Why? Because the growth ambitions are now through the ceiling. Businesses who have been growing through mergers and acquisitions realize that it's a viable strategy, but it's also expensive, and you don't always get that new revenue to the bottom line. And the smart businesses realize that if you don't build your growth engine today, in 2 or 3 years' time, it'll be nearly impossible to catch up because of what AI will do to the industry in that service, that sales proposition area. And so I'll finish here. Advice businesses typically think that they've got two main processes in the business. We've only ever talked about for 20 plus years, a new client process and an ongoing process. They're up for it. A sales and marketing process at the front end, then into your new client process, then into your ongoing process. There's always been three, even if it's been hidden. All we're saying is it's been hidden, and just open it up and look at it. If you don't want to do anything on it, that's okay, but at least being aware that there is the triathlon, the swim, the bike, and the run, you got to have all three of those legs in that order is the first step.
Goodness me. And then, so are there any, in terms of warning signs or symptoms, as you sort of alluded to before, in terms of the, I guess, the context or the history of firms and where we are now, What does a rusted sales engine actually look like? What are those symptoms? You mentioned capability or lack of capability or lack of confidence. I imagine that applies to every single role in the business. But any other symptoms or things where you go, oh, you know, jeepers, like we've got a problem here?
Yeah, when we're working with firms and diagnosing, these are the most common, I guess, thematics or rusted parts of the engine. The first one is advice, and the advice advisors provide is extremely valuable, but the advisors who provide it are hidden. They're not known. And so we used to Google, right? Now we go into the AI tool, right? And the AI tool is now spitting out recommendations of individual advice firms. It can't do that unless your profile is public. And so too many advisors are too hidden, right? And so that is problem number one. That slows down lead generation and it elongates the conversion cycle. It takes 11 to 14 touch points before a client, this is general SME land, before a prospect goes from, I need something to I'm going to sign up for you. What we're saying, and most advisors think that they can do all of those 14 touch points in two or three conversations. We're saying there's this whole digital world, right? Social media, podcasting, YouTube. There's this whole ecosystem that the better businesses are now leveraging to do those 6, 7, 8, 9 touch points 24/7 whilst you're asleep. So that's number one. Number two, this is my second one. I've been doing this sales and marketing thing for 25 plus years, institutional, medium size, small business, including my own. There are very few times, and I'm talking probably less than 5%, where I've seen a business's sales deck, pitch deck, that doesn't have the first 10 slides all about the business. Yep. We do investments, we do superannuation, we do broking. Here's our investment philosophy. Here's our insurance philosophy. Da, 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 da. And the client or the prospect is there going, I don't see myself in this. They're not saying it out loud, but they're going, I'm having to translate what you do and what's the benefit to me. And then we get a bit confused when we put a $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 upfront price and the client gets sticker shock, right? And so flipping, bringing the client into the conversation on an asset is a critical missing part. We do those two things, profile and the pitch deck. Those two things fundamentally change the sales engine for a business. It's kind of like the first, you know, it's probably like the swim part. You've still got the bike and the run lead to go, but it gets you away and it brings confidence into the system. And that would be my second or my third and last point. A lot of this is just about confidence as a human being. We have an aversion to sales because the industry through Royal Commissions has said selling is a bad word. I'm here to change that. If we don't sell, we'll never service more than 10% of the Australian community. And advice makes too big a difference to Australian families for us to not be loud and proud of what we do and sell what we do.
I can really feel and hear your passion, but also I can feel the overlap of number one in terms of we're trying to get these, you know, the Koto. So trying to get these clients or this sales and marketing engine to flow through, I assume, into, you know, delivery as well. Do you see the Koto playing a role there as part of that process, like where maybe tech gets involved or the just process in general, as well as just, you know, working out who do we actually serve and who do we not?
Yeah, this is where, again, leadership comes and threads it all through. Marketing creates the attention. Sales converts that attention to new clients, and operations, the Koto, determines whether that growth can be absorbed. One of the biggest barriers to advisors even wanting to sell more is the fear that the back office can't handle it and letting the client down. That is being used as a valid reason, but also an excuse.
Yeah, that's that is an incredible point. But also I think that is also justifying the current, or this is my opinion, the current cost of advice in terms of it's, you know, taking 5-6 weeks to get that to you. Whereas, I'm going on there. I just wanted to link that to, or thread that into number three. So you mentioned sort of advisors being hidden. We're trying to, you know, whether it's getting them on podcasts or TikTok, et cetera, just actually having them front and center as part of the business. Does that link to trend three, that now advisors are on the move and their clients are following? We're making all these individual stars in businesses. They've got the confidence, they've got the capability, the capacity, et cetera. You know, it's shaping up as a big year for advisor movement. What's driving that, and what should firm owners be doing about it?
Yeah, this is a double-edged sword, Patrick. Yep. One, the mindset of the owner, we encourage to step through that. The more valuable we that the advisor becomes, the more risk it is to the firm. That is true to a certain extent. But if you continue to lead your way through that and set up the right structures inside the business, you can mitigate a lot of that and get the best of both worlds. So look, obviously scarcity of advisors is the number one driver, right? I mean, that's a no-brainer and everybody knows that. It's just simply supply and demand, right? So I'm a good quality financial advisor and there's more demand out there. And so there's an opportunity for that. I think the key here is that advisors, financial advisors are now more than ever looking closely at the quality of the leadership in the firm. What's the growth opportunity in the firm, both in terms of me earning commercially through revenue and selling more, but also my professional development, right? Is the business going places? Brendan uses this term and I know I've adopted it. It's about pathways, not promises. So can you illustrate and demonstrate to advisors, not just advisors, but key staff, this is the pathway for you in terms of professional growth, capability, financially. And it's a pathway. It's not just a promise. And so there's obviously the competing demands that advisors are going, well, is this business going places? And is it leading through the complexity here, right? Versus a firm and opportunity down the road. And so that's both, a threat, if you like, but it's also the opportunity that as an owner, I actually can control a lot of that or influence that by putting in strong foundations in the business.
I love it. Yeah, I love pathways, not promises. But then it's also, as you're alluding to, following through on that actual pathway, because it's one thing to obviously say that, and then it's obviously execution is a big part of it too. Can I ask you to try and link that back to, you know, Advice Tech? What role does, you know, tech and the operating model play in making a firm, you know, sticky for both advisors and clients? Have you ever seen advisors leave firms because of the tech alone, for example?
Probably. If it's not the number one root cause, it's the ultimate. Well, it's certainly a part of that thematic.
Yeah, yeah. So
great people don't want to work inside operational chaos forever. Great people will put up with problems and challenges for a period of time. That can be 3 months or 3 years, right? Depends on the individual. And good advisors are drawn to firms where the kind of the machine and the mechanic helps them to be successful. And so in addition to our clients, see a strong operating model, the role of the COTO, which delivers consistency, responsiveness, and confidence to the client, makes the advisor look good. And so I've got to be careful with this term, but I have a principle in my head that if inside a business, as a business owner or as a operations manager or as a COTO, if I'm making the advisor look good, the business is looking good, and we're winning and we're successful. The minute that because the client's going to come back at the advisor, that's their relationship person, right? And so the operational engine, and I've used this term and I don't really like it, front office, back office, it's actually not the right term, because what happens in that operational engine is everything in terms of how the client experiences it. The advisor gets to translate it, sometimes smooth it over, sometimes bridge some gaps, right? But they can only do so much. And so, you know, sitting at the table, you've got the advisor, operations, and you've got the leadership. And those three things need to be working on the same page as each other.
Goodness me. And then we've got, you know, AI coming through. That's trend number four. So it's transforming the business models of financial planning businesses. It's, yeah, as you know, this podcast, this conversation, all conversation we seem to be having, it's everywhere in every conversation, both personally and professionally. Where are you actually seeing that make meaningful change in advice businesses day to day, Mark?
The first is the obvious areas, right? No capture, summaries, drafting, SOPs, etc. The less obvious is in the faster thinking, the better decision support, the structuring of internal knowledge. By that, I mean, I've seen firms with these magnificent 60-page SOP documents, right? But the staff still go to the person who wrote it because they don't know how to navigate the document or couldn't be bothered. uploading that into Notebook LLM, for example, all of a sudden it's now you just go in there, ask the question, and it brings it up for you. It's like that is game changing. So it's not about the AI tool. It's about getting faster decisions, access to better information to allow people to do their jobs better, quicker, and more effectively than they did in the past. That's where we're seeing it. But I just say, just start in the obvious areas, right? Meeting summaries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And then do you think if we zoom out a little bit, is it changing the value prop of advice or just the delivery? I think about, mentioned we sort of, you know, sharper thinking. We've got all these tools now. So do our clients. So I assume the emails are 7 times longer than they were before in terms of these really well-crafted questions with M dashes and, you know, the document or the SOA or whatever the artifact is going straight into that tool to then come out with questions. So therefore we can feel like we're doubling or tripling our effort because we're just all rising with the same, you know, all ships rising with the same tide. Yeah, is it changing just the delivery or both the proposition as well or the value prop?
Right now it's mostly the delivery of advice. Why? Because that's where advice owners and leadership teams have been focusing for the last 5-10 years, just efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. Haven't had to focus on growth. Go back to the sales and marketing engines have rusted. Hasn't been a focus. So I'm not thinking about it there. So it's all been about removing friction and frustration and compressing time and lifting productivity. But I'm ringing the bell. It's the pressure is going to come on value propositions, and we're already seeing that shift, can already see it. It's made a fundamental difference in my business. It's made a difference in the businesses that we're working with. And I'll use these examples. Access to information by clients is now, the price of that is going to zero. Even Google, compared to what AI can do in large language models, had barriers. Clients now are coming into first conversations and they've gone, I've already ChatGPT, Perplexity, Claude, my statement of advice. I don't use those words. I now want you to validate that, or I've got a question on that. And that is the advisors in there going, I'm no longer in control of this. What's going on? Clients are coming in and putting their phone on the table and saying, it's okay, I'm going to record this meeting. One of the value propositions for advisors was I ask the questions, I control the information, and I'll play it back to you. That's all been disturbed and disrupted. And so if we don't move our value propositions with the times and go back to what I mentioned about the client value has to be articulated in the first page of the pitch deck, i.e. we understand you and your pain points and your problem set, the big risk is that more and more pressure will come under the price that we charge, and that was up to squeeze margins.
Goodness me. And then we are going to run out of time, Mark, but do you think there's any sort of meaningful ways that, like, I think about, yeah, I'm just trying to think about value proposition and now we're sort of sense checking, as you mentioned, in terms of clients are probably coming to advisors with, how can I unravel this? How can you, like, stop me from making this mistake? Is this actually correct? What does the value prop become?
Well, this is the really interesting thing. The value proposition for advice is what it's always been. We've just been really clunky in being able to articulate it. We go to what we're comfortable with. We put the investment process or the philosophy up front, right? Back in the days, not too many of the good firms do this now. They put in, you know, returns, right? And so it's about articulating, well, what is the benefit of uncovering and diagnosing your current reality, right? And it's about having that story about the value to you of having the discovery conversation and articulating what's important to you and where is it you want to go, and then us showing you the steps to get there and breaking that down in client language. So it's what I call just being smarter about how we do what we already do. But as human beings, if it's not a widget that I can touch, we kind of devalue it. And I go, no, you know, peace of mind, sleep at night, comfort, reducing my pain in this area. I'm uncertain about what to do as I'm preparing for and then living in retirement, aged care with my parents. These things are just going on at the dinner tables with Australian families. And we had that information. It's about simply articulating that.
Totally well put. And yeah, it's the return of, or finally the intangibles are having their moment in the sun as they should, which is fantastic. Mark, can you take us through trends 5 and 6, really briefly? And I think in terms of when this goes live, trend 5 will be live on LinkedIn. But yeah, take us through those at a high level and weave them all together if you could, please.
Yeah. Trend 5 coming out this week, conflicts of interest. We call it the sequel. The core point is that the profession, we have told ourselves a really nice, clean story post-Royal Commission that the structures have been cleaned up. They haven't. They're starting to come back in just different ways. And because we think we've seen it before, we're comfortable. We think that comfort is dangerous, right? Because we've seen it before. So knowing what's coming doesn't mean that you're ready. The trend number 6 is the growing gap between knowing and doing. Access to information, even a lot of what I'm saying, is not always new, but it's about, well, how do I bridge the gap between knowing something and then actually doing it? We don't lack for ideas. We absolutely lack for execution. So if I had to connect both of those in one line, the first one, trend 5, is about integrity of the structures, and trend 6 is about the discipline of action.
Goodness me. Can I just ask you really quickly on trend number 5? Are we talking sort of in-house MDA sort of thing in terms of clipping tickets, et cetera? Is there any one or two examples of where that has returned?
Yeah, well, you only need to look at ASIC and the questions that they're asking now around those sort of structures. And so anywhere where an advice business is receiving revenue for a product that isn't just advice, one could reasonably mount a case that there is a conflict. We, as an industry, have put a lot of governance structures around separating those things, but the regulators and government have signaled very clearly that they're looking at those, and the things that have occurred over the last few weeks and months with some of the advice and product structures that have blown up is again only going to accelerate that. So we call it the sequel. It's nothing new. And so we'll keep probably going around in cycles. But I know for a fact that good businesses, this is on the boardroom agenda, and now they're getting to work on it. And to either make sure that they don't go down that pathway, that they stay, in their words, pure, or others that have gone down that way, nothing illegal about it, but are now reconsidering that going forward, because that does represent that regulatory risk. But more importantly, it's a client risk. And there's enough money in the system for everybody without having to click the ticket on every dollar that comes to it.
I'm with you. Yes. And trend number 6, as you mentioned, the growing gap between knowing and doing. So the ensemble audience is tired of good ideas that they can't or don't act on. Is there maybe one or two things that a practice owner or someone close to tech operations should do this week off the back of this conversation?
Yeah, I foreshadowed this. So here it is. I'm going to make this as simple and practical as I possibly can, knowing that it isn't always simple. So 3 things that I would do in that COTO, that operations and technology space. Most tech or outsourcing failures are not really tech or data problems, right? They are business, what we call business design problems. So if the process and the workflow is unclear, then leaders and teams struggle to lead and enact that change, right? And so it's not about looking at the tech and the data first. It's about, well, what actually is the process that we want to fix or change or just improve? Number 2, owners, and only owners or the senior leaders can do this, must define the non-negotiable before implementation starts.
Yep.
I hear this all the time. Once we fix the process, that's like saying, once I have dinner, I'll never be hungry again. There's always something to do. So you have to define a start and an end time to fix that part of the process so that people can claim victory and go, oh, we did that. Let's move on to the next thing. So what process needs to be improved? What does good look like? What data matters? Who owns the decision? And how then the provider or platform or technology fits into that? Number 3, new tech or operations or provider only sticks when leaders lead the change. This comes back to the change management. That means practically inspecting the behaviors, holding people accountable to the new way of working, and managing the provider tightly. All right. So the first thing I would do on all those are 3 principles. First step, just do a 1 hour audit on one broken part of the process. Just pick one, right? You just want to get good at doing this, not whether that's going to be make a game change. Just start with this 1 hour audit on one broken process, assign one owner, right, to fix it, right? Define what does good look like? What are the one, two, or three things that are most broken? What are the steps to fix it? Who then is involved to do that? That then allows you to look at what's the data and then how do we roll that out into the change.
Fantastic. No, Mark, once again, you really make the what can feel complex, you really distill it down and make it simple and actionable and executable. So thank you once again. I really enjoyed today's discussion. What is the best way for someone to reach out to you or Encore?
The best part, connect with me on LinkedIn, Mark Zaglis, or Encore Advisory Group on LinkedIn or through our website. We're spending most of our time helping advice businesses within the Evidentia community grow, scale, and improve their businesses. But we know this, and I'll finish here, ownership is hard. Many are on their own, and we'd love and do share our thinking and a lot of our IP, predominantly through LinkedIn, to get that out into the community. And so there is a lot of practical tips, insights, and IP that we share, no cost, because we just want to help. But more than that, help is no good unless there's actually mechanisms to implement. And so we are doing and sharing more and more of that into the community, because if this advice industry grows, then we all benefit. So it's not about me coming on and wanting to sell Encore. It's just really generally about ownership is hard. Advisors do an amazing job. It makes the most fundamental difference to Australian families. So hopefully, if one or two things resonated from here that is practical for an owner or a leader to use, then that's all that matters.
Awesome, Mark. Once again, yeah, I've got so much out of today's chat, so I can't thank you enough. And yeah, thanks for your time, mate. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you, Patrick.